Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Somebody get my guy, Nigel Morgan, a.k.a. Tony Plush, a.k.a. Tony Gumbel, a.k.a. T-Plush, a.k.a. Tony Hush, a.k.a. Tony Tombstone, a.k.a. Mr. Easy Breezy, a.k.a. Mr. Gotta Be Starting Something, because the Milwaukee Brewers are starting something.
Oh, yeah.
Better yet, the Milwaukee Brewers just finished one thing, and they're starting something else. Last night, they clinched a spot in the postseason with a 9-2 win over the Reds in Cincinnati. That gives them back-to-back playoff spots for the first time since 1981-82. That's back when they were in the American League. Back when Robin Yount, Paul Molitor, they were raking. Raleigh Fingers coming out of the bullpen. And no, I am not hyping them because I'm all about Wisconsin these days. I'd be hyping these guys no matter where they played. Because the fact that these Brewers just joined that Brew Crew from the early 80s is amazing. The fact that they did that given where they were 3 weeks ago is incredible. I mean, I don't care how many times you hear this, it still does not make any sense at all. Back on September 5th, exactly 3 weeks ago, they were beaten by the Cubs 10-5. At that time, they were 7.5 games out of first in the Central. They were 5 games back of the Cubs for the second wildcard spot. And even worse than that, they were tied with the Mets, and they were looking up at the Phillies and the Diamondbacks. So there are all sorts of different metrics that you could use at this point to tell you what their chances were to make the postseason, that they were slim to none. But you don't need some fancy graphing calculator to tell you this. You could look at the standings and see all the work they had to do and the tiny amount of time that they had to do it in. What I'm saying is their season was over. I mean, straight up, it was over, or it should have been. And if it wasn't over on September 5th, when they had so much work to do, then it positively was over on September 10th when Christian Yelich shattered his kneecap with that foul ball. Now, I said at the time, they weren't done because they had won 5 straight, including 3 against the Cubs, and they put themselves back in position to do something. But it was going to be really hard, really, really hard. And then they go out and they make it look easy, actually really easy. They win 17 of 19 since September 5th. They went from no hope to clinching a playoff spot with 4 games to go, and they still have a look at the division. And they've done that, the majority of that work, without the reigning MVP. So at a time when most teams would be saying, I gotta go. And then bail on the last month, the Brewers instead go to work. So how'd they do this? It's not just that they're tough. They are tough, but they're good. They're damn good. And they're a team. As Craig Counsell laid out before the champagne was popped, you need a total buy-in to accomplish something like this and get this done.
Because this is what a team looks like. This is what a team looks like. It's from Mark going getting Yaz for us this winter. Us Big Palm, Ray Black, and Jordan Lyles at the deadline. And then it's the Arizona trading staff getting Brent Suter ready for us. It's Charlie Green and all the player development guys getting Grish ready for us. You guys in this room, man, because you sacrificed everything for this month, and you brought that.
What?
Let's get him!
Here we go, man!
Damn good manager, damn good team, and a total team effort. Like, the pitching staff went from mediocre through early September to the best ERA in the last 3 weeks. Strikeouts are up, walks are down, homers are down, runs are down, and dramatically. They chopped nearly 2 full runs off the team ERA in the last 3 weeks. That's not supposed to happen. Guys who were struggling are not supposed to be able to throw the switch like that, and definitely not in September, but that's exactly what Milwaukee did. And they're not supposed to overcome serious injuries, let alone one to their MVP and other key players. And they're not supposed to overcome crazy slumps, and they did all that. And no, I am not interested in you haters with your dumb takes about how they had a soft schedule coming in or that their run differential isn't that great. You win 17 of 19 at any point in the season against any schedule and you're good. You win 17 of 19 in September with the season on the line and your MVP on the shelf and you're better than good. You can only play the teams in front of you. And as for run differential during this stretch, Milwaukee has scored 103 runs. They've given up 53. That's the only run differential that matters. And it's not like you get to carry those runs over into the postseason. The Astros don't have to win fewer games in the postseason because they've got the best run differential in the regular season. You see, this Brewers team, this is not the story of a gritty bunch of dudes who hung in there. They turned it on at the right moment. They're electric. There has not been this much juice around the Brewers since Niger was talking about his plushdementals.
First off, you know, I'd like to thank Mr. Schwamer for just going over my plushdementals out there. Somewhere I could just work my hands and then just tickle them into the outfield.
Plushdementals?
Plushdementals.
Plushdementals. Hasn't been like this since he was throwing up the tee after accidentally running into game-winning hits and bringing the pain again.
It's a hot day, folks. Niger needs to cool off.
You see it? You see it? Throwing up the tee. There it is. Throwing it up. Yeah.
You know, tonight's over with. We're going to enjoy this for tonight, but tomorrow get back to work and bring in pain again. Oh, I got to go.
Oh, I wish you were back. See, these Brewers have that kind of electricity. They've got that kind of electricity and that kind of heat right now. Can they carry it into October? Can they win the wild card game? Can they even win that division? Can they beat Atlanta? Can they beat LA? I don't know. I have no idea. But anybody who says they can't probably buried them back on September 5th and should probably go slam a Crow Sando right now. You count this Brew Crew out and you do so at your own risk. Better yet, sit back and enjoy the show because this show is awesome. Oh, I gotta go. Yeah, one more thing about them, too. Back to Craig Counsell and the job he's done. I did touch on this earlier, but man, this guy deserves so much bleeping credit and more spotlight and more run for what he's doing. Quickly becoming one of the best managers in all of baseball. And if you think about that job that he's done in Milwaukee, it is amazing. I mean, most of you probably couldn't even name one of this guy's starters. And he's got this club back in the postseason again. Doesn't have that one legitimate go-to horse at the front end, yet he continues to find ways to win. He mixes, he matches, he keeps everybody fresh and focused. This guy was an absolute grinder as a player, and now he is as a skipper. I mean, this dude is a wizard. Hell of a job by Counsell. Brewer fan, you have to love this guy. He needs more credit. I, for one, am going to give it to him. Craig freaking Counsell if you need him. You've got a lot to cover with Dan Wetzel. Dan, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. How you been?
Good, good, bud. Great to have you. All right, so you've got a piece up right now on Wendell Brown, and you've covered Brown and his story for quite some time. But for those who do not know, kind of reset us. Who is Wendell Brown, and how did you first find out about him?
Wendell's a former Ball State football star at Ball State, and he was became a high school, college coach, and a teacher, and he was living over in China, working for the American Football League of China, you know, one of those kind of leagues, and teaching English as like a second language to people in China. Went out one night, I don't know what it was, 3 or 4 years ago, and it's just to a friend's birthday party, and basically a fight broke out. Exactly what happened isn't always clear. It seems like some guys started throwing bottles at Wendell and his group. He's a big dude, and he defended himself and knocked a guy over, and there was a big arrest, and he was the only one prosecuted, which is not terribly unlikely when you're the only African American in the entire bar in China. They put him away, didn't give him a trial for a while. He's in basically a Chinese prison. Finally has a trial. They don't announce a verdict for like 11 months. He just sits there. And then in China, the prosecutor wins 99.something% of the time, so he got no shot. He finally gets sentenced to 4 years in prison. So the first time I heard about it, and the trial apparently was a farce. Very hard to independently verify. The Chinese, they're not handing out, like, hey, can I see the police report?
Right.
Anything like that. None of that's right. happening. So, but he has lawyers, all these different people, you know, they say really didn't do anything. Whatever he did do doesn't merit 4 years in prison. So a couple years ago, we had the LiAngelo Ball and the UCLA basketball players were arrested for shoplifting, if you remember that, in China. Sure. And it was a big deal. And LeVar Ball was kind of at the height of his fame. President Trump got involved. It was this whole chaos. So I wrote about Wendell and his family, who are from Detroit, and his mother is an incredible person. And is sort of the opposite of LeVar Ball and UCLA and all the power and the ability to create, you know, media attention and get the president involved and all these things. Here's this other guy, former college athlete, who's basically wrongly accused or over-accused, sitting in prison and no one's helping. So I started writing about Wendell Brown then, and it was been a long haul and a slow haul. He never really got the full help, but a lot of people did help out. Some documentarians, some lawyers donated time. Ball State football alum, really led by Jason Whitlock of Fox Sports, raised a bunch of money to help him get out. And yesterday he came back to Detroit. He was finally freed from China, and he's back in the United States. So it was a fun day yesterday seeing Wendell get back.
Amazing. One out of four batteries are going to fail this winter. Get yours tested for free during Superstar Battery Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts. If it does need to be replaced, O'Reilly has the Superstar Battery for you. O'Reilly Auto parts, better prices every day. Dan Wetzel joining us. Dan, what's your sense of what Chinese prison is like, and what kind of a toll did that take on him and his family?
It's funny, he would not talk about Chinese prison. At least on the record. I know the food was not good. He was very excited about eating. and it was kind of his number one thing he wanted to do was get some food. The in-flight meal was the best meal he said he had had in years.
Wow.
Which will tell you that much. I think there's a part of it where he does have, there are other Americans in the prison, and he had some friends there. And if he speaks out about China, I'm not so sure that they don't get punished. So he's laying very low, I think, out of loyalty. But he said it's prison. The stories you get from Amnesty International and things like that is it's very bleak. The food is horrendous. The treatment can be horrendous. But I'll tell you, he's an amazing guy, very, very faith-based. He came off this plane yesterday and talked about how it was a blessing in many ways because his faith in God was tested by this. Why would God let me be here? But God got him out, and it's even stronger than ever. So he turned to faith to get through this thing, and he just really, at least publicly, just like, hey, I'm 32. I'm ready to move forward. I don't even want to look back on China. But I'm sure he had a horrific experience. And part of it is that you just, for so many months, he didn't know. I mean, they just jail you, and they don't tell you the charges or, hey, you're going to have a trial on this date or anything. And then when you finally have a trial, like in America, you figure, all right, we had a trial. Am I guilty or innocent? He sat for almost 11 months without a verdict. Hmm. So many times, and they're telling him, hey, you could get life. You have no idea. So the mental strength to go through that unknown, I think, would be even tougher than whatever physical conditions he dealt with.
And then to come out with that perspective is amazing. Dan Wetzel joining us. Before I let you go, why don't we shift gears for a minute? And that is an amazing story. Kansas received a notice of allegations from the NCAA this week. What do you make of that notice?
It's a significant notice because there's, not to get too deep into NCAA parlance, but three level one violations, which are the highest violations. And if you get hit by one of them, you can get a 1 to 5 year postseason ban. And they went right after head coach Bill Self, Hall of Fame coach. And all of it, almost all of the case stems from the federal corruption trials and the FBI investigation that I think most fans have heard about, and mainly the testimony of T.J. Gasnola, a AAU coach who served as Adidas's, they called him the so-called bag man for Adidas. He would drop money off at top prospects, get them to play in the Adidas system, and get them to go to Adidas-sponsored high schools, including Kansas. He was very tight with Bill Self. And the significance is a guy like T.J. Gasnola otherwise would never speak to the NCAA. The NCAA has no ability to, you know, compel him to talk to them, so he would ignore them. Because the feds were involved, he did 2 days on a federal trial, on a federal courtroom under oath, handed over bank records, handed over cell phones, handed over text messages, everything. So the amount of evidence that the NCAA has in charging Kansas is much higher than they would normally have in these cases, maybe more than any other case we've seen through the decades, or at least one of them. So Kansas is going to fight this, and Bill Self's going to fight it, but these are significant charges with significant evidence against them, and it could be very long-lasting consequences for KU and Bill Self.
All right, Dan, showing your range, I'll go off topic one more time before I let you go. Michigan football is coming off that hideous loss to Wisconsin last weekend. Where are they right now as a program?
Well, they get Rutgers this week, so that can cure a lot temporarily. But, look, I think everybody, and myself included, thought Jim Harbaugh would be a huge success at Michigan. Are stunned at where the program is. They still don't have a quarterback 5 years into this. They don't have an offensive identity. They don't seem to have the character to win big games. They haven't won a single game as an underdog. They've won just one road game against a ranked team, and that was a Michigan State club that was 24th last year. They're 0-4 against Ohio State. They've gotten blown out in their last three big games. They got blown out early against Notre Dame last year. They beat all the teams they're supposed to beat. Rutgers and Indiana and all that, but they can't win a big game. And so they're just sort of sitting there as a second-rate team in the Big Ten. And that's what they've kind of been. I'll give you an amazing stat. Michigan has not won the Big Ten in 15 years.
Mm.
And they only have one top 10 finish since like 2003, I think it is. It's something about that. They're just sort of there. They're not winning what you would expect. Now, they've come close a couple times, 2016. Very close down at Ohio Stadium, but it hasn't happened. And you just kind of wonder, if Harbaugh can't get them going, well, you know, who can? And how long do you stick with Jim Harbaugh when 5 years in, there's really not a lot to show for it other than a return to what you would expect, which is beating teams that you have serious advantages over.
And then one quick follow. You got Nebraska coming off a win over Illinois. Now they've got number 5 Ohio State at home this weekend. How big of a game is that for Scott Frost and the Huskers?
Well, it's monster because they're even in more dire spot than Michigan, which is ironic. Michigan and Nebraska shared the 1997 national championship. So 22 years ago, these are the top two programs, and mostly since then, neither one's done much of anything. Scott Frost is trying to change that, and he needs big national attention games because far more than Michigan, there's no local recruiting base at Nebraska. You know, when Osborne and Solis, anybody was doing really well at Nebraska, they were recruiting all over the country. And so he needs to make those statements. So it's a big game for Nebraska. You've got game day on campus. It's always a great place to watch a game. It's going to be prime time, and we'll see what they can do against Ohio State. It's signing their first road test. It's a test for Ohio State. I just don't think they have anywhere near the horses to compete with Ohio State. College football is really divided between these top 5-6 programs lately and everybody else, and Ohio State has maintained themselves in that top bit. So this would be a big statement for Nebraska, but they really need to make it too. There are only so many opportunities to do that, and Scott Frost did a great job at UCF. We'll see if he can do it at Nebraska.
As I mentioned, we were going to cover a lot of ground, and we did. He is a Yahoo Sports national columnist. He is a New York Times bestselling author and the co-host of the Yahoo Sports College podcast, Dan Wetzel, my guest. Dan, appreciate you. Great job. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim. Take care.
There are plenty of people who've had plenty of things to say about Baker Mayfield and his performance. You know, that Baker Mayfield has not progressed, that Baker Mayfield has actually regressed, that he's believing his own hype, that he's not the same Baker Mayfield that he was last season. And one of the guys who's banging that drum is former NFL coach Rex Ryan. Rex Ryan called Mayfield, quote, overrated as hell.
If I have Odell Beckham, Jarvis Landry, Nick Chubb, and there's Baker Mayfield, yeah, I know he's overrated as hell. But
whoa!
I'm like this.
Credit ESPN for that. Rex Ryan saying that Baker Mayfield is, quote, overrated as hell. Now, somehow that made its way back to Baker Mayfield. And if for some reason you thought that Baker Mayfield was no longer Baker Mayfield, if you thought that maybe he had changed or gone corporate or anything like that, you thought wrong.
In the wise words of Freddie Kitchens, if you don't wear orange and brown, you don't matter. And Rex Ryan doesn't have any colors right now for a reason, so it's okay.
That's strong. That is really strong. How about him dropping that quiet dagger at the very end of that? Just a casual reminder that Rex Ryan is not coaching, that Rex Ryan has not been coaching for a while, and that there's a reason why Rex Ryan is not coaching. In other words, have some, Rex. In fact, have a lot. Now, I would say pot meet kettle, but of the two guys, Baker Mayfield and Rex Ryan, only one of them is overrated as hell. And it's not the guy with the Heisman Trophy. And it's not the guy who rolled into a brutal situation in Cleveland and led them to a 5-2 mark down the stretch last season. It's the alleged head coach who's known for sweater vests, snacks, and embarrassing moments. In other words, a lot of things that have nothing to do with winning football games. And by the way, it's pretty rich for a guy with a losing record as a coach to be calling anyone overrated as hell. But especially that guy. The same guy who talks so much junk when he took over with the Jets, bumping his gums about going to the White House and guaranteeing Super Bowls, only to get canned after going 4-12 in his final season with the Jets. That's the guy who's calling somebody else overrated as hell, despite the fact that he couldn't get over 500 in his last 4 years with the Jets. Despite that fact, he somehow stumbled his way and talked his way into a job at the Buffalo Bills. And then he painted up his truck like a dope and got fired before his second year had even finished. The guy who yelled about stuff like this.
Last year, hey, we were under the radar. That's a good place to be. F*** that. The best place to be is when expectations are high. Get used to it. It's always going to be that way. And now let's go out and prove everybody right. We know we're better than you. We don't give a f*** if you know it or not. We don't give a f*** if you give us your best game. We're going to give you our best game, and we're going to beat the f*** out of you. How's that? Let's go get it.
Yeah, it's great. And then he got fired before the end of his second year. And then complained to the Daily News that the reason why it didn't work out in Buffalo was because he had set the expectations too high and he just had some bad luck. Because that's what legendary coaches always talk about. Setting the expectations too high and having bad luck. Quote, I set the expectations too high. Like, boy, that's a shock. In a way, I felt, why not us? I stepped in where the head coach had quit. The defensive coordinator quit. And the quarterback quit on them. So I thought that it was important at that time to say, you know what? Shoot, I believe in you, and I'm proud to be the coach here. Every bit of that was true. I put that truck with the Bills logo around town. I was all in. Even though those other three had quit, I wasn't a quitter. I was ready, and I wanted to be there, and I wanted to win, and I thought that I could win. End quote. Not only did he get fired, he had to repaint his truck. Quote, let me tell you, I stripped that damn truck the day I got fired. Bleep you guys. End quote. So again, that guy, the guy with the career losing record, the guy who had to angrily repaint his truck after he got blown out before his second season was even over. That guy's calling somebody else, quote, overrated as hell. His biggest contribution to Bills, or to Bills history, are sound bites like this.
Here we are. Here the f*** we are.
His biggest contribution to Jets history is this.
Let's make sure we play like the f***ing New York Jets and not some f***ing slap f***ing team. That's what I want to see tomorrow. Do we understand what the f*** I want to see tomorrow? Let's go to eat a goddamn snack.
All right, just so we're really clear on this, that's the guy calling somebody else overrated. And Mayfield's response was perfect, because Ryan isn't wearing colors, and he doesn't have a coaching gig. Unless a team decides they want a loudmouth self-aggrandizer to lead that team to a sub-500 record, Rex Ryan probably won't get another head coaching gig. Now, let's be clear about this. I'm not saying that Baker Mayfield has been perfect this year. Far from it. He knows that. He's working on that. And it says here that he and the offense will figure it out ultimately. Freddie Kitchens was there to pick Mayfield up, and he said this about Rex.
I appreciate his opinion and all that, but he's not in our building. He has no idea what we're doing. So I'd answer that with that.
And that's fair. Rex Ryan's not in the building. He doesn't know what Freddie Kitchens is trying to do as a head coach. Honestly, even if Rex Ryan were in that building, I'm not sure that he would know what Freddie was trying to do as a head coach. And then when somebody asked Kitchens about Mayfield and whether or not he's a one-read quarterback, as Ryan claimed, Freddie said this.
Is he a one-read quarterback? No, he's not. I mean, that's asinine to even say.
So again, I want to be very clear about this. I'm not saying that Mayfield's been great. Far from it. Not this year. What I am saying is that Rex Ryan should be awfully careful about throwing around phrases like overrated as hell, because they've got a way of boomeranging on you.
And Rex Ryan doesn't have any colors right now for a reason, so it's okay.
The head coach of Tulane is Willie Fritz. Willie, good to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's an honor to be on your show, Jim. Thank you.
Willie, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks for making time. Now, you've been around this game a long, long time. You've had a great career. But how many games have you had with an ending like the one you had against Houston?
Oh, I've had some that have kind of been close, but not the two-play combination there at the very end. It was, it's a play that we've been working on quite a bit. Our offensive coordinator brought that here with him, Will Hall. I thought it was a perfect situation to call it in, and our running back, Amari Jones, did a good job. It's a fake kneel down play, which a lot of people do at the end of ball games to, have a safe way to run the clock out. But we would go ahead and act like we're running a sweep one way, hand the ball to Amari. He took off running, did a good job of getting out of bounds. We had one timeout left. We were going to throw the ball over the middle of the field and, call a timeout and kick a field goal. And Jalen McCleskey, a wide receiver, caught the ball from Justin McMillan and was able to bounce off a couple guys and run in the end zone. So it's pretty exciting finish to the ball game.
It actually was incredible. Willie Fritz joining us. Willie, back to Amari for a minute. Amari Jones was playing with a broken nose, and he picked up roughly 18 yards on that play. He gets out of bounds. The thinking at that point would be get into field goal range, give yourself a shot. What was the play that was called, and what kind of emotions did you feel as that unfolded?
Well, just he called it a kneel play. And I mean, it just looks like you're in victory formation and you're taking a knee going into overtime. I read something the other day. We played Auburn here a few weeks ago, and towards the end of the first half, they got in that formation, and Will was quick enough to tell me, hey, I think they're going to try that play. I called a timeout just to make sure our defense was ready, and sure enough, I guess Coach Malzahn was going to do it. But it's a play that you see occasionally. Probably won't see it again this year in college football, I don't think. But he'll be prepared for it. But if you would have got tackled, it would have been a loss of one. Same thing that would have happened if the quarterback would have gone back and really taking a knee. So it's really not as risky a play as maybe people think.
Yeah, but so in that moment still you execute, and you execute beautifully. But the fact of the matter is, before the ending, if you were to go back earlier in the game, Willie, Houston got up on you 28-7, less than 2 minutes into the second quarter. What was the mood like on the sideline at that point? And then what was it like when you went into the locker room down 28-14?
You know, our guys were really geared up for the game, and sometimes maybe that, you know, you get a little bit too geared up. We haven't been in the limelight, you know, a whole lot here at Tulane over the last few years, and I think our guys were maybe a little too charged up and ready to go. We had too many penalties in the first quarter, missed assignments. We get behind 28-7. We go into we know that we're you know, get down to 28-14. We're, you know, receiving the second half kickoff. Talk to the guys about just keep chipping away at it. We had a good first drive to open the second half. We're down 28-21, and then really dominated, I thought, most of the second half with our run game and occasionally throwing the football defensively. And they started running it more, and you know, it was a different pace game in the second half than it was in the first half. But our guys just kept fighting, scratching and clawing, and found a way to get it done. Proud of them.
Willie Fritz joining us. You know, you were proud of them, but you made a point of telling them how much you love them after the game. And listen, I know that's the kind of thing you're going to say, whether you win or lose, but why was it so important to make sure that these guys know exactly how you feel about them?
Well, you know, sometimes you get into those games, everybody has those emotions. We're around these guys darn near 24/7, you know, all about their lives. We feel like we're a transformational type staff and, you know, want to be involved in these guys' lives. And, you know, win or the bad outcome, we're still behind them 100%. We still love them just like we would do after a win and all those kind of things. So it was a lot of fun. We get in the locker room sometimes. We have some fun in there and get a little silly because you work so hard and you want to have a little fun after a big W.
So, Willie, what's that mean when you say that we feel like we're a transformational staff?
Well, just helping these guys make this, you know, from 18 to 22 years of age, you know, it's tough. You know, you do a good job, you get a degree from world-class institution like Tulane, and you're going to be set for life. You make a mistake during that time period, you know, you're going to have some problems overcoming it. So we want to be good role models and mentors to these guys and help them during this really tough, you know, time period in their life, you know, being away from home first time for an extended period of time in their life, all those kind of different things. I'm lucky I got a great staff that models this behavior for these guys. And we've recruited a lot of great young men. We've had very few problems, knock on wood, here at Tulane, academically, off the field, those kind of things. And I think it's a credit to the kids we're recruiting.
We're talking to Willie Fritz for a few more moments. Now, it's a program that's had some ups and downs, but you had been very clear that you felt this was a place where you could win. What were the opportunities that you saw in that job before you accepted it? And then how much fun are you having proving some of the doubters wrong?
Well, I love taking these kind of jobs over, and our goal is to make Tulane a consistent winner. Last season was the sixth winning year in the last 37 years. So I recruited guys that wanted to do something that hadn't been done here, but consistently win. You know, I looked at the program from afar. You know, as I said before, we're the number 40th ranked school academically in the country out of over 4,000 colleges and universities, so that's a plus. We play in a great conference. The American, I don't think it's the credit that it deserves. And then last but not least, we get to do it in the number one destination city in the world, according to the New York Times in 2018, NOAA. So there's a lot of great things that you can have happen to your life. You make the decision to come to Tulane.
Willie Fritz joining us. Now, Willie, your father, Harry Fritz, coached at Central Missouri. He ran the NAIA basketball tournament. The story goes that you used to go to those games, and you saw some of my favorite guys ever. What was it like to see guys like Dennis Rodman, Terry Porter, and Rick Mahorn back in the day?
Oh, it was awesome. We'd go. They'd play 32 games in 4 days. And, you know, most of the time I'd see 30 of them or 31 of the games. I'd very seldom miss one. Some of the teams you had to go see, they'd start the games at 8 o'clock in the morning. You'd go all night until, you know, midnight with the games. But those were great, great memories. And, you know, my brothers and I used to work a little bit, but more so we watched the games and predicted which one of these guys were going to be a star later on. And a bunch of them ended up being big-time NBA players.
When you first saw Dennis Rodman, what were your impressions? Did you know that he would dominate on the next level the way he did?
Well, you never know. You know, I think his game was an early morning game, as a matter of fact. I mean, he had some incredible numbers. He had like 30-something rebounds and a bunch of points. And he was all arms and legs back then. And you never know that. You know, the one I thought had a good idea was going to be pretty good was Terry Porter when he was playing with Wisconsin, Stephen Point, I believe. He knew he was probably going to be a stud at the next level. And then Jack Sigma, you know, it was him and four other guys out there playing, and he dominated the game as well. But, yeah, you never know with that. It's interesting to see those guys in that environment and how they do. And, it's big time for them at those games. And certainly are great memories that we've got from going to the NAI National Tournament in Kansas City.
Hey, Willie, I saved the really critical, really important stuff for the very end, but is it true that you never had a po' boy before you took that job at Tulane? And have you jumped into the po' boy life since arriving?
Yes, I have, without question. I just had one last night, as a matter of fact. I'd never had one before, didn't know what it was. And that's one of the things that's tough here in New Orleans, just figuring out where to go eat. There's just so many great restaurants all across the city. I went to a new one last night that I hadn't been to before that had a great roast beef po' boy. So nobody complains about the food here in New Orleans.
All right, so for those who have never had one before, what is the experience like? What is that life like now?
Oh, it's just a stuffed sandwich. It's on a hoagie. You always want to get it dressed. With the roast beef, they put a bunch of gravy on it. And, the first time I thought I'd get a big sandwich. You don't ever want to get a big one. You just get a regular one. That'll be plenty for you and maybe one other person. I actually put on about 15 pounds in my first year and a half here. I just finally lost it back. And that's from going to all these different restaurants. If you're on a diet, it's not as good a city to go eat in. But if you love great food, it's a fantastic city.
Willie Fritz joining us. It is a fantastic city. Tulane won their fifth bowl game in 125 years last season. They're coming off that amazing win over Houston. And next up, they are at Army. It's October 5th, and the game is right here on CBS Sports Network. Willie, it's great to visit with you. Congrats on that win. Great to have you on the show, and thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. Roll wave.
For some reason, Rex Ryan throwing around the phrase overrated as hell made me think not of Baker Mayfield, but of John Gruden. I'm not sure why. It's like I just heard those words and immediately thought of Gruden's return to Oakland, which even the most diehard member of the black hole would have to say has not lived up to all the advance hype. But it didn't feel that way in the season opener when the offense was clicking against the Broncos, and they did so without Antonio Brown. It seemed like the Raiders might be turning the corner and Gruden might possibly be starting to live up to that massive contract. And as Gruden pointed out, when the Patriots signed Brown, the Raiders were not going to miss him because he had not been around that much in the first place. Gruden said, quote, "We were good in the preseason without him. We're going to be fine without him," end quote. It's kind of hard to argue with that guy at that point. I mean, it's hard to miss a guy who had barely been there in the first place. Hard to miss a guy that when he was there, he was threatening to punch coworkers, allegedly. Never mind that was a guy that Gruden brought in. Never mind that was a guy that Gruden worked so hard to keep. Never mind that Gruden fought so hard to ignore all the issues and keep him around, to the point that he hung his own GM out to dry after that threat of violence. Never mind that Gruden only got rid of this guy when he had no choice whatsoever, and he had to get rid of him. But when they won their first game without him, Gruden wanted everybody to know that they were just fine without Antonio Brown. Fine without him in the preseason, and fine without him in the regular season, and they were going to be fine moving ahead. I bring that up because all of that was earlier this month, but it feels like a lifetime ago. Because since then, the Raiders have lost their last two games by a combined score of 62-24. Even worse, they jumped out on top of Kansas City in week 2, 10-0. So they've actually been outscored 62-14 in their last seven quarters. So for a head coach who's got this reputation of being an amazing offensive wizard, that's not a good thing. But don't worry, he's got an explanation. There is a reason why they've had so much trouble in the last two games. Gruden has got his finger on the pulse. He knows exactly what the problem is.
This caused us a little bit of rethinking. You know, when you lose your starting Z, who arguably is a great player, and I don't think anyone's going to dispute that, you have to replace him. And we're making an effort to move Tyrell around. We're bringing on some younger guys. J.J. Nelson also got hurt. Don't forget that. He was hurt. Dwayne Harris got hurt. So we've had some multiple things to deal with, and we're dealing with
it. Wait a minute now. So Antonio Brown is the reason why you're having so much trouble right now. I thought the guy didn't matter. I thought you didn't need the guy. I thought you didn't miss the guy. I thought you were the one who said, we didn't have him in the preseason, didn't matter. Can't miss a guy who was never around. Remember when you won that first game? The offense was fine. You said everything was fine. You said we're good without Antonio Brown because he was never here in the first place. So you lose your next two games, and what happens? What's the reason? Oh, we don't have Antonio Brown. We miss Antonio Brown. Don't you people know how hard it is to replace somebody like that? Don't you know there's a reason why we brought him in the first place? Why do you think we've gotten hammered two games in a row? We don't have Antonio Brown. Oh, and don't forget about the injuries. There have been a lot of injuries. Don't forget about them. Man, that turned pretty quickly, didn't it? A few weeks back, they were great without Antonio Brown. Now Gruden wants everybody to know they don't have Antonio Brown. And that's a big reason why they are where they are. Oh, and guys are getting hurt. So to recap, the reason why the offense has struggled the last two games is because a guy who didn't play in the preseason that they didn't need anyway isn't there. The guy you said you didn't miss after week one is not there. That's why you are where you are right now. Oh, and the injuries. The injuries. Because that's always an acceptable excuse in that league. Way to take ownership of that situation, coach. It's an amazing pivot. There's even more. There is even more. I mean, that's enough, but there's even more. He also dropped this line. Quote, I'm not going to put it all on Derek.
And I'm not going to put it all on Derek.
Man, that's big of you, Chunk. Very stand up. Way to take ownership of it as the guy leading from the back. I'm sure Derek Carr really appreciates you running him under the bus. Having his back. Saying Khalil Mack didn't want to be a Raider. Can't believe how absurd that statement is. I'm not going to put it all on Eric.
And I'm not going to put it all on Derek.
I'm not going to put it all on Derek is pretty much saying you should all put it all on Derek. I mean, yeah, I am the offensive guru. I am the kind of person who should be able to scheme up things to have success. But I want everybody to know I'm not going to blame the quarterback for the offensive struggles. Nope, I'm not blaming it on him. I'm blaming it on a wide receiver who was barely here that I said that we wouldn't miss. Oh, and I'm blaming it on the injuries too. Don't forget about the injuries. In other words, just know there's a lot of really bad stuff going on here right now, but none of it's my fault. Nor will it ever be my fault. I guess what I'm getting at is this. Whatever happened to the idea of success is shared and failure is the responsibility of the leader? Hear me out. Success is shared and failure is the responsibility of the leader. Isn't that a thing? That if the team doesn't win, it's on the coach to figure it out. Turns out that's not really a thing. Even better than sharing success and owning failure is owning success and sharing failure. He's got that down. Even better than that is owning success and blaming failure. Not sharing it, but blaming it on the guys who aren't there and blaming it on the guys who are hurt. Just win, baby. And if you can't do that, blame others, make excuses, and own nothing, baby. Come on, Chunk. It's called accountability. Make sure we're clear on that, okay? Make sure we're clear on that, all right? Knock on wood if you're with me. My guest is Sean Porter. Sean, good to have you on. How are you?
I'm great, Jim. Good to hear from you again.
Yeah, you too, Sean. Good to have you back. You know, I would ask you how camp is going, but I saw a video of you lying on a bed eating a bag of lettuce and a packet of tuna, and you make it sound like it's actually pretty good. You've made it pretty clear you're not going to go to the front and say that you enjoy it, but you appreciate it because you know what you got to do. What do you mean by that, and what's the vibe been like throughout the camp?
Oh, man, the vibe has been amazing. The entire team, we've been on one accord. And, you know, the mindset is to shock the world. I think the world is probably shocked to see me laying there eating lettuce out of a bag and a packet of tuna. And what I mean by when I say, you know, it's what I have to do, so I appreciate it. You know, you get to a point where, you know, the calorie intake is very low. And, you know, I don't know about other fighters, but for myself, you know, I eat and then I'm on a scale just to monitor everything, you know, so. My dad brought that to my room last night, and a thought crossed my mind that that's something that I think the world should see. Everyone sees us get on the scales. Nobody really sees how we make it. You know, a lot of times they see us and they look at us and say, oh, he doesn't look healthy. He doesn't look like he, you know, he lost weight correctly. And I just wanted to show everyone out there how I'm losing weight but still eating and maintaining my energy and things like that. So that's kind of what the video was, just a little silly video, but also to give people insight on, you know, how it was done the Porter way.
I like it. Sean Porter joining us. You know, you mentioned your dad. And, Sean, talking to you right now, you and I spoke about a year ago, but talking to you right now, I can, again, get the energy and the enthusiasm coming through the phone. Your father, Kenny, said about you, quote, he's never had a bad day. When he'd move up a grade, his teachers would invariably tell me, I'm going to miss him so much, end quote. So where does that mindset, that attitude come from? Were you always like that, or did you develop that?
It comes from him. It comes from my dad. It comes from my family, my upbringing. You know, I just said the Porter way. I think, you know, the Porter way is really doing whatever it takes to be successful, living a good, healthy life, and being happy, being proud, and being joyful, and being at peace. You know, so those are small creeds that were instilled in me at a young age, and it's just things that I've been able to hold on to. And, you know, it's a part of my life, my daily lifestyle.
Sean Porter joining us. You've got the unification fight coming up this weekend. It is a pay-per-view fight. You know, Sean, I could talk to you about mindset and approach the entire time, but let's talk some boxing. Styles make fights. You're stepping in against Spence Jr. on Saturday at Staples. When you think about him as a fighter and an opponent, what kind of thoughts do you have?
You know what? The thought yesterday when we were at the official press conference, the last press conference, I had the thought and the feeling that he's going to come at me, and I think that that's exactly what we need. We need to make this a fight. We need to, you know, be able to hit him, and the best way to do that is if he's right there in my face. So, and that's the kind of fighter that he is. He likes to be aggressive and take control, and, you know, and he's always very, very technically structured, you know, right down the middle with his 1-2s, you know, he digs the body as well, so... Nothing, he doesn't really do any movements that are going to be surprising or anything like that. So just to get in the ring with him and see him stepping forward, to me, will be a good indicator of how the fight will play out. I think, you know, his aggression against mine will make it exciting for the fans. But I think, you know, being smart and beating him to the punch, I think that's the way to get the job done.
Sean Porter joining us. All right, so him coming forward, how much of that is about his style and what he normally does? And then how much of that is about maybe him trying to motivate himself? As an example, he said that he's going to knock you out. Nobody has ever knocked you out before. So what was your reaction, and do you think he was trying to hype himself?
Yeah, I think it's two things. I think, number one, his approach in the ring is to be aggressive, but it's not aggression like my aggression. I'm on top of you nonstop. Round by round, you know, he more so picks his punches and, you know, he just does not want to take any steps back. So, and then I think that another reason, you know, that makes me feel like he's going to want to come at me is because he's going to want to prove that he can knock me out. I think he's going to want to prove that to himself and to everyone out there that he said it to, you know. So I think he's got a lot on his back right now, and the best part about it is, you know, we're in the same position we've always been in. You know, we've always been counted out and not expected to do the things that we do. And time and time again, we pull through. So that's what we're looking to do on Saturday night.
Sean Porter is joining us. That fight Saturday night. You know, Sean, you're coming from a place of, I think, respect and humility. It seems like part of the buildup to the fight, he was coming from a place of disrespect in the sense that he was trying to minimize your accomplishments. He even called you a dirty fighter. What do you make of him doing that?
Yeah, I think he kind of, in a lot of ways, he's lost track of, you know, who he is and who he's been. I think he's been a pretty upstanding guy and a pretty respectful guy for quite a while. And I think that, you know, when we announced this fight, I think things just kind of changed for him. And so, you know, I think when he's – the things that he's saying in terms of me being dirty, in terms of me being wild, things like that, I think it's all – he's, you know, those are all subliminal messages that he's trying to send everyone. And, you know, I don't expect him to work. I don't know if he even believes it, but, you know, come fight night, you know, there's not going to be anything dirty coming from the Porter side. Everything will be clean and aggressive. And exactly what we need to win this fight.
Sean Porter is joining us. And what's a little unusual to me is the two of you actually go way back. So he knows where you started. He knows what you're about. And, in fact, your father, Kenny, who still trains you to this day, Coach Spence, way back in the day. Does that matter now? Do you feel like that gives you any kind of edge?
Well, you know, my dad said it yesterday. We understand his mindset. And if you can understand a person's state of mind, whether that's in a sport or whatever, you can take control of that, you know. So we know that he's not going to want to take any steps back, and we expect at some point in this fight for him to start to do exactly what we want him to do, you know. So I think that is something that my dad had saw from him as a youngster, that he, you know, is very headstrong and very determined, and that could get you in trouble sometimes, you know. So you know, we're expecting that to play into our hands. And, you know, as far as knowing him for a long time, I think that, you know, I was a professional before he was, so he's been watching me for a long time. I think in a lot of ways you talk about him being disrespectful or, you know, downplaying things that I've done. I think that he wants to be what he's seen me do, and he wants to be in my position now. And I think that that's the reason why he's downplaying it. But, you know, you and I both know that on the night of the fight, when you get inside of that ring and bell ring, there's no turning back after that.
No turning back. And you know that as well as anybody, Sean. You're a two-time world champion. You know, as well as you fought in the past, has the world yet seen all of Sean Porter in one fight? Or when people tune in this weekend or they go to Staples on Saturday night, are they going to see something completely new from you?
No. I honestly think that I've given the world much of what I have. Not all in one fight, but I've given them much of what I have time and time again. I think the fight that I've probably come the closest to is Danny Garcia as well as Keith Thurman. I think in both of those fights you could see a bunch of different styles coming from me and a bunch of different movements and actions that helped determine the outcome of those fights. I think with this fight right here, you take Keith Thurman, you take Danny Garcia, you put them in the blender, mix it up, and you're getting all of that in one fight against Errol Spence. So this fight, in just a few days, you will see the best that Sean Porter has to offer the world.
I think also, Sean, against your Dennis Ugas, I thought you showed some different ways to get it done as well, and it proves that you can win in multiple ways. How do you see this fight ending on Saturday?
You know, I really don't know. I obviously expect to win this fight. I do think that there's going to be some things that we can do to take control of Errol Spence and really manipulate him and get in his mind. And I think from a physical perspective as well, I don't think that people recognize how strong I am and how prepared I am to take this fight to him, which no one's ever seen before. So it's really hard to say how this fight's going to play out. You know, he may, you know, try to do what he did against Mikey Garcia and stand more on the outside and box me. I don't expect that to happen, but, you know, we've seen him do something different as well. So we're prepared for everything he's got, and I honestly do not think that he's prepared for everything that I have. And I think that that's the separation there in this fight, which is why I feel so confident that I'm going to win.
I know where your focus is. One last thought. I want to remind people you're from Akron, Ohio. You are a diehard Cleveland Browns fan. I've been hyping these guys since early last season. How are you feeling about the team right now?
You know what? I'm reminding myself to be patient. I understand that, you know, there's 16 games in the season, not just the three that we've had so far. So I got my Browns shirt and even my son's Browns outfit. They're on standby, and Sunday we'll be in Browns gear, ready to support my team as they continue to get back on the right track. I think so far it's been a little struggle, but it's in the grand scheme of things, this is a brand new team in a lot of ways, even from the sideline perspective, brand new head coach. So. And a lot of adjustments, and I think we'll be all right.
First things first, you got that showdown Saturday night. It's a fight we've been talking about all week long on the program. It is Spence Jr. v. Porter. It is live pay-per-view. You can get that on the Fox Sports app as well. He is a two-time world champion, the WBC welterweight champ. Sean, great to get caught up. I appreciate you making time before the fight. Good luck on Saturday.
Thank you.
Kyle in Green Bay is the king of the clone stocks. He's setting it up. Let's find out what's going on. Kyle, my man, how are you?
Romy, it's a beautiful day here in Green Bay. We are out here on the corner of Holmgren Way and Mike McCarthy Way. We got four kegs. We got a jug of vodka lemonade. We got bread. We got sandwich meat. We got bottles. Fireball. We are setting up. It should be a rager. I just want to let you know, all the clones know, New York, I'm coming for you next week with Chris no longer in St. Pete, John in New York. But first things first, let's pound these kegs, Green Bay. I can't wait to see you guys. Romy, Cardboard U is here. He's looking on. You're here in spirit. Thanks for everything you do. And I'm out, Romy. Have a good one.
All right, Cal, be good. Take care. Be careful. Wow, did he just say that we have bread?
Good night now!